Okay. We promise not to take up too much of your time. We want to make sure you get a good chance to have a drink. So what we've decided to do is to show you a series of pictures in the atlas which are going to scroll through. Our contributions this evening are going to be in direct proportion to the amount of effort we put into the atlas. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get an idea of who worked hard on it, who was lazy. It's interesting doing a social atlas of Europe if you are English like I am, because you suddenly discover that you don't understand very much about Europe. You were never taught very much about Europe. In fact, you are basically learning where various countries are that you ought to know where they are, if you're called a professor of geography, and it's slightly embarrassing, particularly if your co-authors were born in Greece and, well, Switzerland stroke Germany, Ben can explain. And automatically speak two languages very well, if not three, if not four. We decided to do this project some time ago because of a shared interest about what was happening on the continent and because of a feeling that there was a lack of interest in what was happening to Europe, particularly in England. And it was very surprising to find that there wasn't a kind of atlas of Europe already existing of this kind, especially given the amount of money the European Union has to pay people to do various cartographic things. We decided to get together and have a go at doing one. Now my colleagues are going to speak next. Regis is going to explain some of the ideas behind it and the ethos behind it, and then Ben is going to tell you how the maps are actually made, and I'll wrap up towards the end. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you everyone for coming. As Danny said, this social atlas is something we have been extremely passionate about. We have been discussing this idea for some time, and we feel that it comes at it's very timely. It comes at the time of a great crisis in Europe and worldwide. There's an apparent revival of old national stereotypes and nationalisms. We feel very frustrated about that, feeling very strongly European. As you will see, one of the maps today, this rolling presentation, is the percentage of Europeans who feel that European above every other identity. I think we would be fair to say that we are amongst this small but rapidly growing minority of Europeans. It is particularly frustrating, I would say, to see the discourse, the media discourse in Britain with regards to Europe, a Euro-sceptic, Europhobic discourse, and giving you the impression, just to reflect on the recent European elections, that the Euro-sceptic parties, even the BBC described this as a Euro-sceptic earthquake. You get the idea that they dominated the election, when in fact the Euro-sceptic parties did better than they did before, but they're still a very small minority, as Ben is going to illustrate later on with some of the most recent maps building on this work. So the media discourse in this country and the recent elections, the coverage of the election, gives you the idea that the revival of old divisions in Europe is inevitable, that the process of European integration, ever closer union in Europe, should be halted or even reversed, when in fact the parties that won the election, the European election, and across Europe, the dominant parties are pro-Europe parties. They are parties that support strongly the European dream, the European idea. The best example is perhaps Italy, where Matteo Renzi, despite the recession, despite the fact that Italy is one of the most hardly hit countries in Europe by the recession, he won the election, his party won the election with a landslide victory, 45%, and before the election he would say things that we have to push for the United States of Europe, we have to push for keep the European dream alive, echoing to some degree something that most people perhaps in this room wouldn't know, echoing people like Winston Churchill, who said back after the Second World War that he was looking forward to the United States of Europe. He was looking forward to the day where Europe will unite as a whole, that he was looking forward to that idea. He's one of the founding fathers of the European Union. People in Britain tend to omit that fact. And there are passionate politicians and people across Europe that are still, they believe in the European dream, the idea of Europeans working together, a common European identity and a common European future and are very passionate about the ideals of Europe, the modern Europe, such as respect of human rights, social cohesion, the abolition of the death penalty, quite a few of these things that signify European identity are part of the maps that we present in the Atlas. And there's also a small but rapidly growing number of European groups, informal and informal, like the New Europeans and the European movement in Britain, who celebrate the idea of European identity and of a common European identity and support the idea of a common European future. And I would say we would like to contribute to this debate. We are among these people. Another interesting fact is that despite the Eurosceptic media discourse and the way events have been covered, there is still, even now, according to the most recent Eurobarometer survey, nearly two-thirds of Europeans feel that they are citizens of the European Union. And even in Britain, it's more than half, 51%. We are amongst these people. People feel citizens of the European Union despite the bad press, despite the political scapegoating of Europe and the European idea. So as three European geographers, who stress European, whose first languages are Greek, English and German, we feel that the best way to contribute to these debates and to the idea of bolstering European identity is by visualizing Europe and its history, its economy, its social history, socioeconomic geography, its physical and human geography at the same, simultaneously, using state-of-the-art geographical information systems and human cartogram techniques in order to contribute to these debates and give a sense of Europe as one place. We hope that, and we feel that by visualizing Europe, the countries we included in this atlas are all countries that have demonstrated a strong commitment to a common European future, all the European Union, current European Union members, as well as all candidate states, members of the European Economic Area, and so forth. All countries that are eventually, hopefully, going to be part of the European Union or be closely associated with it are part of this atlas. And we want to show, bolster the European identity, the idea of European home. I think there are some people in this room, I remember having conversations with them about the idea of what do you say when you are asked in the United States, for example, where are you from? Increasingly, people would say, I'm from Europe, and then say which state in Europe they would come from. And there is a new, young generation of Europeans who increasingly would do that, we think. Also, the Atlas demonstrates the advantages of showing regions, thinking of Europe as a Europe of regions, not of nation states, a Europe of people, a Europe of regions and cities, and illustrating the fact that there is... quite often, the divisions are more significant within countries and within cities rather than between states in Europe. And they are more in common between European regions across Europe. So, for example, to give you an example of South Yorkshire, Sheffield, where I'm currently based, South Yorkshire has more in common from an economic geography point of view, perhaps, with places like the Ionian Islands region in Greece and Crete, or Leipzig in Germany, than with London in the South East. Whereas London has more in common with Oslo, Belgium, Brussels, and other very affluent metropolis across Europe. Looking at university graduates, the human capital, West Yorkshire, I see quite a few people here from Leeds, West Yorkshire is a 100th in Europe as a region in terms of the percentage of the population who have a university degree. This is just above Athens and northern Denmark. So again, comparing that to London, where more than half of Londoners have a university degree, there is a lot there to look and consider. So we put together a database drawing from on data sets from Eurostat, European Value Survey, the World Bank, a wide range of sources to put together a data set that could be visualized in different ways using alternative human cartography methods, and building on a very successful and very exciting work in geography, in human geography over the recent years, and also building on the most recent refinements of these methods, award-winning techniques, gridded population cartogram techniques that Ben Henning developed as part of his PhD. So I would like now to hand over to Ben, who is going to say a few words about how these maps were created, before showing you some more examples.
Okay, hello everyone. For those of us of you who don't know us yet, the reason why we use cartograms as maps in this book is because we like these types of maps. We don't necessarily say they are the better version of maps, but we think for what we want to say and what, from a human perspective, these might, in many cases, be the better option for actually visualizing things. And just that's what the first slide is meant to show. Just bear in mind, cartograms look like distorted maps, but so does any other type of map projection. On the top left, you have the Mercator projection, or on the top right, the Peters projection. They're all distorted versions of actually the three-dimensional sphere of our planet. The only difference in our types of maps is that we put different types of numbers into actually creating these distortions. And we're building on the work that we all started in the SASI group in Sheffield, which is the World Mapper project, where you see this population cartogram of the world for, just to give you the sort of comparison how the different types of maps looks. The bottom map is a cartogram that distorts or resizes each of the countries of the world according to how many people there are. And that's the sort of very basic principle in the maps that we use. And what we've been doing in the Atlas of Europe is very similar to what we've been doing in the World Mapper project before, like visualizing basically anything we could possibly get data for in such a way of using quantitative data to resize issues. But we're not talking about the world, but about Europe here. And because Europe is more about more than just nation states, as Dimitris already said, we needed to find different approaches into how we visualize the data that we have. In many cases, we've got national-level data. Therefore, that technique that we used in World Mapper is quite suitable, having one number per country and then resizing that country accordingly. But in many other cases, if we want to demonstrate that Europe is like a Europe of regions, where the different regions are probably sometimes more similar to each other than countries are, we needed a different type of projection, and that's sort of what I just briefly tried to explain to you in this image here. On the bottom left image, you see the world population cartogram that you've just seen before. One country, one number. On the bottom right image, you see the world split up in little grid squares, where each of the grid squares is resized according to how many, in this case, how many people there are in that place. So you see it simplified in the top image. You have a certain area, you split it in individual grid cells, you reallocate the number of people who live in that area, and then the square with four people in there is four times bigger than the one on the bottom size. It still appears in the shape of a square, even if it's not a perfect square anymore, because all the borders connect, which allows you to draw different type of information on top of these maps. And we use this approach in many cases where we've got more detailed information about the regions of Europe, which gives you a more detailed picture of how the living conditions in Europe are. To make this a bit more plastic, I'll show you a little extract of a short animation that gives you an image or an impression of how such a gridded cartogram transformation works. It starts off with a normal map of Europe and then slowly transforms into a gridded population cartogram. It looks a bit distorted on the edges because it's taken out of that transformation for the whole world. So what you see on the right side is like China and India pushing Europe a bit further to the west because there's many people in Asia. But if you focus your eye on Europe, you slowly start Europe changing its shape now according to how many people live in each of the areas. And you slowly start to see the capital or the major metropolitan regions becoming bigger. And if you do that type of map projection for Europe only, this is the kind of base map that you end up with. The colors in this image just give you an impression of the altitudes, which you know from normal topographic maps. The brown areas are the highest regions, and the darker green areas are the lowest regions. And that already shows you, you can draw other geographic information on top of this. These maps and see that information in relation to the population distribution within Europe. So that is one type of the maps that we use in the Atlas. So here the example for the unemployment rate in Europe. And then we use it like a normal choropleth map, so we draw other information on top of that. So the highest unemployment rates are in dark blue. We use quintiles here. And you can compare, for example, or you can see actually that some regions like Spain, southern Italy, for example, parts of Greece, Ireland, are very similar to each other, and then you see how the different areas of Europe compare. But not in relation to the countries or to the land area, which overemphasizes rural regions, but in relation to the population distribution. The other type of maps is national level maps, and that will be the same data used on such a national level cartogram, and we have these types of maps in there where we've got information on national level and where we want to highlight national differences. So basically what these two maps show, they show the very same information but in very different ways to give you different insights into the actual issues that we want to visualize. So here each country is resized according to how many unemployed people there were counted in 2012. And the third type of map is like a mixture of the two maps, is a map that distorts the national level areas of Europe and then displays other information on top of that. So that is the technical bit, and then Dimitris already mentioned the sort of selection of countries that we made and the visual impression of what we did in these types of maps took us a while to work out. First of all, the selection is based on taking all countries that are either member of the European Union or somewhat linked closer to the European Union by being part of Schengen, for example, like Switzerland and Norway are. Britain isn't. And those countries which are at least in the candidate status or potential candidate status. So that is, for example, the reason why we don't have Ukraine or Russia in there, which people occasionally ask us. The real advantage of using these countries as well is that Eurostat has a good database for that, and many other databases give us more detailed information about these regions. But our main choice was really to look at the European Union, how it currently looks, regardless of how, where it may develop in the future. And then the color scheme that we used, the colors aren't random colors, but we used like a rainbow color scheme, sorting the countries by the year of their accession either to the European Union or signing the treaty like the Schengen agreement. So the founding countries such as Germany, France, they are the deepest purple, and then the potential candidates like Bosnia-Herzegovina are the reddest areas, so like the candidate countries which haven't even really started negotiating their status. And in between, you find the different layers for the different years. And within each of the colors, we modify the colors so that you're able to identify individual countries. So within one color range, so for example, if you compare Germany and France is a bit lighter than Germany is because France has fewer people than Germany has. So we try to modify the colors within the rainbow scheme a little bit more to actually get the differentiation. And so in the most extremely distorted maps that you've seen in the previous presentation, you can identify the countries, even if it's just one or two countries standing out. And the last technical bit, or less technical bit, of course, Europe doesn't end where we map it in the atlas. Actually, the data in there is already almost outdated by the time of print because it constantly develops further and there's always more exciting information to map. That's why we started the website europemapper.org, where you at the moment find sample pages from the book and already the first updates, and we try to sort of maintain it and publish further updates there in the future so that we find new maps on there. And we also have the obligatory like Twitter, Facebook, where you can like us and follow all the information when we put new things, so you see the book launch where you are at the moment, it's already on there. And what you will find on the website in future are things like, for example, taking a look at the most recent European elections to the European Parliament, which has just been published in the Political Insight magazine, which we put online in the forthcoming weeks. Dimitris already mentioned, you can see from this chart here, the Eurosceptic parties are a quite small minority, whereas the major parties, the EPP and the S&D, they are still pro-European parties. And then, for example, in this paper that we've just published, we map the election results and see where the seats of the different votes come from in Europe. So the EPP, the sort of conservative wing right wing in the European Parliament, as you can see here, where no British party is a member of currently. That's why Britain is actually non-existent in this map. And on the other hand, this is a sort of real right-wing, conservative wing where the Conservative Party is part of. Accordingly, of the 70 seats in the Parliament, Britain is quite big there in there. Or if you look at the Lib Dems, which had an enormous wipeout in Britain, you see that liberal sort of strength in the Benelux countries. And we could go on, like UKIP being represented here, and the party of this comedian in Italy being quite strong there. Or on the other side, the European left, for example, the Syriza, which isn't particularly a Eurosceptic, a European sceptic party, won the elections in Greece, which is probably sometimes a bit overheard in the debate about the right-wing movements in Europe. And that was my last slide. So with that, we just try to bring you to the website as well. So after you've bought the book, you can go to the website and find further updates there in the future. So we keep working and being committed to the project. And with that, I think I hand back over to Dimitris. He has a few more words to say before Danny finishes.
Just want to say before we give you a chance to refill your glasses in the theme of co-production, we have co-consumption of wine, and have a chat about the book for people who want to stay and talk to us. There are 13 chapters in the book. This set of slides give you a flavor of maps from different chapters and various quotes. There is also extensive commentary of all the maps in the book. There are copies here for you to browse through. And with this PowerPoint presentation, which we leave running through, we are trying to give you a flavor of some of the maps from each chapter. So once again, thanks for coming, and I'd like to hand over to Danny for a few more.
Right, thank you. Hopefully that's given you an idea about what's in the book, why we did the book. There were a large number of issues about how you do things, what you include, are particular statistics comparable or not. What we thought we'd do is not take any questions, but just be here to answer any over wine if you've got a particular interest in how enough, if we think we could map that and so on. Because it can get very technical and it can get a little bit boring. We wanted to spare you from that. We had endless arguments about the colours and so on. We've already had quite a few emails. Particularly people on the green side of Europe worried about the different shades of green. So a remarkable number of countries you have to find unique colours for. And so we had that kind of problem. The one thing I mustn't forget to tell you is that there are copies in the back. They are discounted, just £15. You'll never get them as cheap again. Particularly off Amazon, which of course is based in the middle of Europe, not here, for various reasons. But we really enjoyed doing it, and it certainly taught me a lot more about the place I should have known more about. And lastly, if you're wondering why we launched it today, we were of course waiting for Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage to actually find seats to say they're standing, as those two people who we thought would really appreciate getting a copy of the Atlas. So if there are a couple left, I think we're going to send Boris and Nigel a copy. Thank you ever so much.